One thing is the eternal learning curve. The more you know, the more you realize you have more to learn.
At the end of the day, you can be as good as gold, but if you don't have passion for wine, no matter how good you are, it isn't going to work.
And Mother Nature is your partner all the way until it's done.
Whereas the U.S., you go into a big grocery store and you have 2,000 different glass bottles full of wine.
My father told me, never work for money. Work to accomplish something. Making money is the result of doing something right.
The bottom line is, it's all about the soil.
Well, the results are really the benefit of our doing our homework.
What makes winemaking so interesting and fascinating is that every single year it's been different.
There was definitely a sense that we were all sort of in a pioneering endeavor. It was fun.
We say, so drink the wine. That's kind of our motto here at Life Between the Vines. One of the cool things about wine, besides drinking it, is the people you drink it with. And the stories you hear and tell with wine all come together to make every bottle unique. Discovering and tasting wine shouldn't be a homework assignment. And we believe that the people who are closest to wine have the best stories. So open a bottle and welcome to podcast number 129.
This week we feature Aaron Weinkopf, winemaker for Spotswood Winery in St. Helena. He's a winemaker, vineyard manager, husband, and a new father. Aaron Weinkopf is a busy guy. Aaron is the winemaker and vineyard manager for Spotswood Winery in St. Helena, and we managed to catch up with him at the winery fresh on the heels of harvest. Thus, two new vintages were brought into the world. Spotswood is one of the best-known labels in Napa Valley, and I'm here with Aaron Weinkopf, winemaker for Spotswood. How are you doing, Aaron?
Doing pretty well this morning.
I want to jump in real quick and say this is a very smiling man because he's a brand new father, and I say congratulations to him, his first son.
Yeah, thank you.
Born
August 31st.
In right in the heart of harvest.
2 days before we picked their first block of red.
When he asked for the car keys, I suggest you bring this up to him.
Yeah, exactly.
This is kind of an unusual day. We've got some rain.
Okay, yeah, finally.
I guess we're just getting into the beginning of that season. Yeah. So, yeah, is there some kind of a feel for what kind of a season we're looking at here? Are you thinking you're going to get a reasonable amount of rain?
We have nothing left to do but try to be optimistic and hopeful.
Yeah.
Of course, the conversations are that, yes, it'll be another El Nino year. When that kicks in, conversations are a few months from now, but it's just one of those things where prognostication is what it is. So yeah, we're hopeful, but they say even if it is wetter, it will still not be an extremely wet year. It would probably just be close to average, which is better than what we've had for the last 2 years. Not enough to replace what we've been borrowing on.
Yeah, that's just it. I guess there's a little bit of stealing from Peter to pay Paul going on, right?
Yep. Yeah. Always in agriculture, it seems.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Let's talk about agriculture. Obviously, you are the winemaker, which also brings you to the side of farming. You are a farmer.
And also the vineyard manager, technically. So.
Oh, so you really are. Yeah, definitely a farmer.
I am.
Yeah. Uh-huh. When did you start into this whole wine for a living thing?
Oh, wine for a living thing. That goes back a few years. I really started when I was going to school in Spain. That was kind of my first introduction to wines, the world of wines. And when I came back, it was right when my dad was kind of making his transition from beer to wine for health reasons, naturally.
Mm.
But started getting to enjoy some good father-son time around that also. And at the time, I had finished up with one degree and knew that it was not what I wanted to be doing. So I was happy to start looking again and stumbled upon it for a myriad of reasons and just thought, you know, it was such a beautiful combination. I'd grown up out in the country doing 4-H, working out in the garden in the fields pretty much every day during the summer. So that aspect of it was always really close and near and dear to my heart. So yeah, needless to say, when the opportunity to do something that was a really beautiful mix of science, of art, and of farming, all of a sudden lights came on and I was like, already.
Again, just this big smile. It's very infectious. It's very cool. Are you a native Californian?
No, I'm born in Tucson, Arizona, and grew up in Nevada.
Really?
Uh-huh.
Okay, I have to be really honest, and I know there's agriculture in a lot of states, but you don't think of either of those states when it comes to agriculture.
No, not normally. But yeah, quite a bit of agriculture down in Arizona, of course, hot weather. Once again, talking about robbing from Peter to pay Paul, you know, everything down there is that way since it is the desert. Mm. But quite a bit of agriculture, especially in southern Arizona, long growing seasons, they can grow a lot of things. And then Nevada is just so much open land. I mean, whether it's just whether it's forests, hay fields, there is a fair amount of agriculture just outside of Reno. But no, it's still high desert, so people really have to be wanting to be there and wanting to be doing what they're doing to be there.
So, how long ago did you move to California?
Let's see here. I moved here, I think it was 2000. Specifically, moved to. As a Nevadan, one of the last things I ever told myself I would do was live in California. And just the old habits die hard. But yeah, needless to say, it was a cool opportunity. I had set my sights on Fresno State, so I went down to Fresno to get my enology and viticulture degree.
I didn't know this. Is there a thing between Nevada and California?
A little bit.
I never knew that. So were you a wine drinker before all this? Was wine part of your life? Or
no, ironically, it wasn't. Reno has a fairly large Mormon population, and a number of my friends throughout high school were Mormon, non-drinking. So it really wasn't part of... It wasn't a part of my family's own history and habits, and wasn't part of the groups that I was growing up with. So it really wasn't until I went to Spain where I really had my first kind of introduction to it. And I think for me, it was a nice introduction because it was a cultural introduction as opposed to a high school drinking introduction.
Right. It wasn't about getting drunk. It was about enjoying wine as almost a part of food, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And that's when it was. It was midday glass of wine.
So now you're at Spotswood, and I have to say, you could have done worse. So
certainly.
Yeah. How did you come to become the winemaker at Spotswood?
I guess as with a lot of good things in life, there's a little bit of chance and luck involved. So, basically, while I was going to school down in Fresno, I had been working at a winery, all aspects, winemaking, managing, working in the tasting room, etc. It was a small Central Valley winery. Mm-hmm. But it was a neat introduction. So then when I had the when I graduated, I figured if I didn't get out of there then, I'd probably be stuck for a while. And I didn't have any real deep ties to the area, and so wanted to come up here to this area. So took that opportunity, went and interned at Paul Hobbs for an extended harvest internship. And at that time, I had some friends that were working already, that had graduated before me, that were working over in this area, and they had connections here with Spotswood. So when they started looking for an assistant winemaker, they said, hey, any good candidates out there that we should meet or talk to? And he mentioned my name and just went through the interview process, and luck behold. A few months later, I had the position. So yeah, as soon as I finished my internship, I came straight here and started working. Worked as assistant winemaker for about the first 3 years, and then had the opportunity to take over and do some vineyard management also for a few years. And then in 2011, was named winemaker.
Wow, that's great. So that would have been, you're talking about 2006.
2006 was my first year here.
Well, that's great. Congrats. I always like to hear that somebody climbing the chain like that, especially as a winemaker, because you're so much more in tune with the property or if you're leasing or whatever it might be.
It's a little different, and I know I had, you know, you see the bouncing around and the opportunities to go and work in Southern Hemisphere and Northern Hemisphere and see the world as a winemaker. Those are wonderful opportunities, but I know I had already gotten to a point where I just realized that, you know, so much of what I thought was important was being able to watch the vines and have the time to observe. And those things, those feelings and those gut intuitions, those don't develop overnight. I mean, you can have them from other things, but I think the deepest ones and the most pragmatic, reliable ones are the ones that come with time. So I was looking to get into a spot where I could just kind of buckle down and become a little reclusive.
And here I am dragging you out on a rainy day to talk. It's funny actually watching you look out the window. There's sort of a little bit of a longing in your face. You really are a farmer. I mean, you could just see that, you know, I could almost see the dirt in your hands at this point. And that's what makes a great winemaker. I mean, really the idea of knowing exactly what's going on out there.
Yeah, it's a huge deal. I mean, as winemakers, we have the opportunity to do some things, but our biggest and best opportunity is to just not mess anything up, and so taking advantage of what's coming in from the vineyard is and having good quality fruit coming in from the vineyard is really one of the most important things.
I've heard that from a number of people, that idea of not messing something up. It is sort of taking Mother Nature's perfection and guiding it properly.
Exactly. And I mean, we have, once it's off the vine, we have tools, but they're somewhat limited. I mean, they're not organic biological tools in the sense that, you know, Mother Nature has a lot of tools working all at the same time and a lot of things driving this one, you know, this the innate growth. And once it gets in, we have some tools, but they're not quite so dynamic.
Sure. Is your wife by any chance in the business at all?
She is, yeah. She's French. She works on the sales and marketing side and has a little label that she does on the side that her and her partner continue to work on and develop and hone all of their myriad of skills. But yeah, it's good. We don't have too much pillow talk that's focused around production only, so that's good. And a little more diversity in the family is healthy.
I think it's very healthy, yeah. You read my mind on the pillow talk thing, because that could be really interesting in a marriage when you've got that commonality.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I guess let's get to a couple of facts here. What is the output of Spotswood?
Output of Spotswood is variable. Ideally, we're going to be close to 10,000 cases, whites, reds, and side projects. So yeah, that's the main goal. We've had years where we've been as low as 5, and this is just within the last probably 5 years, and then years where we've been closer to our goal of 10.
Mm. So it's nice, comfortable size, though, when you get right down to it.
Comfortable enough, yeah. We knock on wood, we don't have to flip tanks, so we're able to still just stick with and really baby each fermentation as it goes through. Sauvignon Blanc is 100% barrel fermented, so still have room. We have years where we push those envelopes a little bit, but yeah, in general, big enough that we're financially viable and can get out into the markets and hopefully supply the markets with what they're demanding or close to it. And then at the same time that we're small enough here that we can embrace everything intimately. It's the same group of guys working in the vineyard as work in the winery. So we're constantly going back and forth and constantly just finding that balance between where the work needs to be done and what we're doing.
I think it's interesting and unique when you have the same crew doing that, because obviously that brings about a real team atmosphere, a real tight crew.
Team atmosphere, tight crew. Obviously, it's an intimacy too with what you're doing and what you know, and it's valuable to see things go through all of their stages, whether it be from bud break to pruning, and see the drawbacks or the benefits of some of the actions we take and how they carry on through. Mind you, over a year's time, a lot of that becomes correlation or just vague memories of what actually happened earlier on in the year. But yeah, it's a neat thing. It's a special thing. It's an intimate thing. And I think it's, you know, certainly part of what keeps us grounded and makes the product what it is.
Now, from what I've seen, Spotswood is available pretty commonly. Again, a very, very highly regarded brand, obviously not just here in Napa, but around the country. But as far as distribution and availability, what are we looking at here?
To my knowledge, we're still in all 50 states. We're still, well, obviously, we have a mailing list that accounts for a good chunk of sales. But because we've been doing this for so long, we have very good and important relationships in the wholesale market also. So we have always made sure that we allocate some for wholesale and some for the mailing list, and continue to believe there's a good balance there, and all of those markets are extremely important. So yeah, we're still in all 50 states, still, you know, I think, yeah, distribution in general is probably a little bit more heavy in the restaurant world, but there are still a handful of retailers that are able to get it, and you know, those relationships that have been in place for 30 years usually are pretty well cared for.
I would think so after all that time. Good God.
Yeah.
You have some wine here, and we could record part of this if you would like to pour some. I'm totally up for it.
I'll certainly try.
Thank you. While you're pouring. Yeah. It's a question I love to ask winemakers, especially since we were talking about your dad a moment ago, but what do you like to drink?
Wine. Gin.
Not at the same time, of course.
Not usually at the same time, no. No.
Ouch.
It either would have had to have been a really bad day, or need a really good excuse for me to drink them both at the same time.
Yeah, that would be a very bad day.
Yeah. But no, and then my brother's been into tequilas and whiskeys. Oops, whiskeys, scotches, and tequilas. So and then of course working in this industry, tequila. It's good to know your tequilas so you can talk with the other half of the working world here.
An important part of the working world here.
Yeah, the ones who get it done.
Yeah, that's right. And dedicated above all else, too. I mean, there's so much history with a lot of the workers here in the Valley, and that's really important for people to know that.
Yeah. Well, shoot. Our oldest, other than Mary, our most long-term employee is Jose Luis. He's now been here since 82, since it started.
That's a good period of time. Wow.
Yeah. Big chunk of time.
You want to talk about the first wine here?
This is the 2013 Sauv Blanc. I did actually decant it this morning along with the reds. This is the 2011 Spotswood Estate. The Lindenhurst is not the 2011. I pulled it. We're sold out of the 2011. And so I just pulled the 12 just because I honestly hadn't seen how it's been doing since it went into bottle last. And even on a cool rainy day, that still works.
You do nice work.
Thanks. I really do love the varietal. It's amazing how many hats it can wear when you try to compare. I mean, comparing New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc to Sancerre to White Bordeaux and any one of those in and amongst themselves. They're really different wines, and you can certainly see the characteristics of Sauvignon Blanc come through in them, but the diversity of styles within the world of Sauvignon Blanc is just fascinating to me, and real spectrum. Well, it's the one thing that I like to think about our Sauvignon Blanc, not just ours, but California Sauvignon Blanc. I mean, it's capable of being really a quintessential Sauvignon Blanc, because we do have that diversity within our soils. We do have that diversity within our microclimates, where we can achieve almost everything that the varietal has to offer. And it can be such a gift. And of course, it can give you as the winemaker lots of opportunities to try different styles. Yeah. I mean, stylistically, we're looking for something that is acid-driven, but at the same time, viscous. We want it to have texture. It's not the cheapest Sauvignon Blanc on the market, but we like to think of it as one of the better Sauvignon Blancs out there. And within that, certainly look for it to be not dominated by its oak. We really want the varietal to show through. So,
what does it sell for?
I think it's 36.
Not that bad at all.
Not too bad.
Not for a quality wine like this. Funny thing, when you mentioned something about this time of the day, it occurred to me you could drink something like this for breakfast. Obviously, you can't drink a full glass of it, but it does sort of have that quality to it, doesn't it? That exactly. Little morning freshness. You take just maybe a shot, if you will. Mm-hmm. It's a nice way to start your day. As long as your boss isn't smelling your breath.
Yeah, unless you are the boss.
I can do that.
I can too. I think I have to do it.
If you don't have a job anymore.
Maybe not every day, but Certainly a few times.
Do you have times where you have to back off because of your palate getting a little bit flat, that you're just sort of feeling, you know, maybe I need a bit of a rest?
Yeah, I mean, I think our, you know, blending sessions can be extremely challenging. When you're going through and examining trials and stuff and really trying to be precise and calculating. And at the same time, I couple that with the one caveat that I think it's really valuable, whether it's on my side or as a consumer, being able to see a wine evolve. Because I think the wine's ability to evolve in the glass, not in the bottle or in barrel or anything, but in the glass, it's a great window on what is the wine. When you get to see what it is once it's been open, when you get to see what it is once it's an hour old, once it's 10 hours old, once it's 24 hours old, watching the evolution of those wines, seeing how their structure holds up or doesn't hold up to air, seeing how their aromas evolve, change. It's cool. So it's a neat thing. Not only when we're tasting and doing blending sessions, etc., not only are we going through trying to do an evaluation on them, but then we kind of have to sit around, give them some time, and go through and do it again. So it's, you know, when you're tasting hundreds of times, you can't help but get some palate fatigue. And even if you're spitting constantly, you're breathing in enough alcohol that I feel it.
Yeah, but the idea of approaching it and keeping that objectivity from taste to taste to taste, that's just got to be so hard.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I specifically, because of its challenges, I like it when we can just focus on 3, 6, 10 wines at a time, evaluate them, take a few minutes to go do other things, put new blends together, etc., re-pour, like not have everything too staged and too successive and immediate, so that there is time to let things happen.
But it's exciting too. I mean, you implied that. That's very exciting.
I mean, once it goes into bottle, our objective is that it has, you know, more or less a year in bottle. So we're looking for things to go through their evolutions. And a lot of it for me is I just, whether it's faith or whatever it is, you have to know that what you did with it was good, and that it is a good wine before it goes into bottle, and be comfortable with the fact that it is going to be what it's going to be, and enjoy it once it gets out. Once it goes in a bottle, that, and of course July, especially in a year like this that was early, that's right on the cusp of harvest, that's right on the cusp of baby. But yeah, right on the cusp of a lot of things. So there's still a lot of work to be done and a lot of other things to focus on. It's the work side of it. It's not all tasting and blending. So one of the things that we've always prided ourselves on, and one of the things that we feel very, very necessary, very important to what we do, is that a wine is both a representation of its place and a representation of its time. So we look for the vintages to be unique and to be different, and regardless of that, and try to embrace it. And so the spectrum that we've had from 10 to 11, 12, 13, and now 14, they're all over the place. And every single vintage offers its challenges. You know, this year, of course, we head into it worried that we're not going to have enough water, that people that were irrigating before bud break because they didn't think there was going to be enough water in the soils to even push, or at least to get a good solid push and be able to carry a full crop. Just so many different things. And then of course we get some late rains, all of a sudden everything's perfect. You know, we have a pretty good water holding capacity in our soils, so enough rain that right when bloom came there was still enough water in the soil that, you know, we've got great cell differentiation multiplication, and so we ended up with good crops in a year that we were worried that we wouldn't get even an average crop.
No, and
so it's just it's always surreal how things continue to change. You go into a vintage with premonitions or plans, at least based on what you think could happen, and then you just start playing with it, changing it up, and taking it as it comes. And every vintage has had its challenge. You know, 13 and 14 were very warm, very early vintages, fairly good crop loads. But how we manage heat, for me, is oftentimes more important than how we manage almost anything else specifically here on our site, because we are looking for a wine that presents itself with balance, with beauty, and with freshness. And those oftentimes are the things that are most susceptible to high heat and to late ripening. So, you know, we try to make sure we're on target with a lot of our work so that we can get things off when we're supposed to and when they are at what we think of as their prime. And so each vintage, whether it's cool like 11 marked by rains, the bookend of rains, or whether it's the high heat of 13 and 12 and just how all of that gets mitigated. And then they surprise us. I mean, we had so much heat leading up to Verasion in 14, and then it cooled off. And yeah, I think the wines show nicely. A big crop. But in and of itself, it'll be a beautiful vintage, but hopefully, at least from my perspective, they all are.
Did it bother you when you saw that, you know, 11 really took a beating, from what I've read? And I, in my personal opinion, I felt that was a bit unfair and also maybe a little bit of a blanket as opposed to looking at individuals as much as they should have gotten that recognition.
Yeah, I can help but agree with that to a certain extent. But in the end, I mean, even the critics, we're all individual tasters. We all have this archetypal vision that we're looking for when we're trying to compare and score and evaluate what we think about these wines. And because of that, it's not a surprise, not even a worry when something doesn't necessarily get the acclaim that another one does. At the same time, the ability to appreciate a wine and continue to watch it and enjoy it is invaluable. And hopefully, the one thing that I do hope for is that people aren't dismissive because of a lower score. I understand completely that people have things that they're targeting, things that they compare to, but to be fully dismissive, I think eliminates a whole world of both of not only the wine, but of just life in general. We don't skip past years and in our own life, and I think it's in a lot of ways pretty similar to wines. I mean, they are all of the same life forces that come and go, all of the processes that happen every single year happen again. And the reality is I taste the 11, and I think the 11's, it's beautiful. It is the sounding board. It is the contrast to almost all other, not all other, but at least the five or six closest vintages around it. And it is because of that, and it's different, it stands out. It doesn't have necessarily the exact same nose, it doesn't have the exact same aromas, but that doesn't mean that it's lesser. It's almost the opposite now, because it is pretty unique. We were enthusiastic, we loved the wine, we thought there's still weight, there's texture, there's beauty, there's aromatics, there's tannin, there's fruit, there's everything you want. And it'll be age-worthy. I mean, this, and it's going to be cool. This in 10 years, like 98's another malign vintage. Mm-hmm. And show pretty darn well.
Yeah, it just happened the other night. Mm-hmm. Aaron, this has been a real pleasure. You're such a pleasant guy to talk to. I love watching your face when you talk about, you know, your love of what you're doing. And again, maybe a little of that has to do with being a new dad. Again, congratulations and thanks for your time. Mm-hmm.
My pleasure, Ray.
Learn more by visiting spotswood.com.
Thanks for listening, and remember to like us on Facebook. Also, check out our YouTube channel.
Life Between the Vines was produced at Fifth Floor Recording Company in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Produced and edited by Ray Pfister. Original music by Tim Turton. Web design by Jenny Holland. Our web geek is Dan Geeshan. Photos by Jeanette Herniak. Copyright 2014.